We arrive from many places, from places of wholeness and places of brokenness, from places of success and from places of struggle, from places of love and acceptance and from places of rejection, from places of joy and places of pain. We come to be with others whose company we need in good times and in bad, to be reminded that ours is no caravan of despair, but one of love and hope, of justice and inclusion. So come, whoever you are, from whatever place you are in your life today, and know that something of what you need is here. You know that the NFL is grateful for Ebola. It seems like a strange and awful thing to say. But prior to the Ebola outbreak, the news headlines were all about incidents of domestic violence against women and children committed by NFL players and the lack of appropriate response from that organization. The news media may have turned their attention elsewhere, but the problem of domestic violence in the National Football League and in society at large has not gone away because the news coverage has stopped. In today's service and in the forum in the community room, which will follow the service, we are going to shine the spotlight back on the serious problem of domestic violence. Now, unless you are in some far-off place without a television, you saw the surveillance camera footage of Ray Rice, a star player on the Baltimore Ravens, in an argument with his girlfriend, now wife, Janet Palmer, while they were waiting for an elevator. And inside the elevator, things escalate, and we see Rice smashes her head into the wall so hard that she's knocked unconscious. The elevator arrives at the floor, the door opens, and Rice nonchalantly drags her out. It's hard not to be shocked by this incident. Then there's the incident of Adrian Peterson, running back for the Minnesota Vikings, who stuffed leaves in the mouth of his 4-year-old child and whipped him with a tree branch and a belt, causing bruises on his back and buttocks and cuts on his legs and thighs. Rice and Peterson are not alone. There have been 87 arrests for domestic violence-related offenses involving 80 different NFL players over the past 14 years. Yes, football is a violent sport, and we could discuss how the culture of that sport may contribute to men being abusers. But I don't want to spend our time there. Truth be told, the percentage of arrests for domestic abuse in the NFL is actually lower than for men in the same age categories in society at large. Now, that shouldn't be totally surprising, as the famous and well-positioned in general with the protection of wealth and privilege are less likely to get arrested. These incidents themselves are shocking. But what is more so is the league's effort to cover them up and not deal with them in an appropriate disciplinary fashion. These men are role models to lots of young men, especially men of color. And for the league to give a slap on the wrist or to look the other way sends a terrible message to these young men, and may well perpetuate the cycle of domestic violence to the next generation. There is, I believe, a special obligation on an organization like the National Football League to set a standard of no tolerance and to do what it can to send out a message to their fans that in every circumstance, domestic violence is wrong. And to their credit, now, some of the players are now involved in an effort to do just that. But domestic abuse is not just an NFL problem. The statistics about our society at large are staggering. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, in the United States, 20 people per minute are victims of physical violence perpetrated by an intimate partner. 20 per minute. Those numbers add up to about 10 million cases a year. Intimate partner violence accounts for 15% of all crime. 1 in 5 women and 1 in 7 men will experience serious physical violence at the hands of an intimate partner at some time during their life. And the chance that high school age girls will experience violence in a dating relationship is 1 in 3. The rate of domestic violence for gay men is about the same as for heterosexual women, and there is a 50-50 chance that a lesbian will suffer domestic abuse, but not necessarily by a partner. 1 out of every 3 women who are murdered in this country are killed not by robbers or thugs or unknown rapists that break into their homes, but by their present or former partners. And on top of all these staggering numbers is the well-known fact that most domestic violence goes unreported. Domestic abuse happens among people of all races, all classes, genders, economic levels, religions, and sexual orientation. You know, more than twice as many women in this country were killed by domestic violence than soldiers who were killed in Afghanistan in the same time period. But we don't see their photos on the nightly news, do we? It's a problem of monumental proportion that cuts across all levels of our society and has horrible consequences, not only for the direct victim, but also for children and other family members and for generations yet to come. Yet for the most part, this problem remains hidden and not really taken seriously. It's what families don't speak about. It's the dirty little secret hidden in the darkness of fear, shame, dependence, rejection, self-blame. You know, last week, in the sermon, I told you I'd handled hundreds of assault and battery cases as both a district attorney and as a defense attorney. Well, many, in fact, probably most of them, especially when I was a DA, were domestic violence. And in my early years as an assistant DA, now sorry to admit about 35, 36 years ago, victims' rights legislation was just coming into effect in this state, with some services for battered women and children in the legal process. Throughout my career, I spoke with lots of women who had been physically abused by a spouse or partner, and the vast majority did not want to go ahead with the case or even change their living situation. There were lots of reasons for this. Economic dependence was high on the list, and of course, perpetrators behave amazingly well if they know they're going to court and possibly going to jail. But it was very rare they ever did. Lots of time, if the couple was married, based on the law in Massachusetts, the wife would claim her absolute right not to testify against her husband, and the case would have to be dismissed unless there were other witnesses. Often women blame themselves or blame something else, like alcohol. I should not have gone out so much when he needed me. I started the argument. He's fine when he isn't drinking. He promised he'll never do it again. I should never have called the police. Those were lines that I heard over and over again. Sadly, some women believe having a man who beats them was better than having no man at all. Even mothers with children who had been abused by their man would often refuse to testify. I remember one case like it was yesterday, where a beautiful little girl had perfectly burned little rings on her arm. Her father would punish her if she cried by holding a lit cigarette to her arms until it branded her. She might have been 2 or 2.5 years old. I'm sure if you saw the pictures of Adrian Peterson's little boy, you were probably shocked by the bruises. But compared to the police photos of women and children and some men that I saw while I was a DA, those were nothing. I also want everyone to know that indeed men are also victims. In my time as a DA back then, Many of those men were closeted gay individuals. And even if one got the courage to call the police, they would likely be ridiculed rather than helped. Particularly in gay relationships where there was a great power or economic difference, I saw the poor, economically poorer, weaker dependent partner abused and almost without recourse. And I also had a case once where a woman broke her husband's skull with a cast iron frying pan. The vast majority of victims of domestic violence were women, but certainly not all. Often I would see individuals leave the courthouse with their batterer hand in hand after the dropping the charges or refusing to testify, and I would know that it was only a matter of time before they would be back in court after a similar or worse incident, that is, if they were not killed first. I worked in an office that tried very hard to connect victims to services and to help them, but so often they were too afraid or too self-loathing to take advantage of them. Thanks to the kind of advocacy many groups do now, like those groups that we support, things are getting better. More women are taking advantage of help. More children are being protected. But as a society, we have a long way to go in addressing this pandemic that a former U.S. Surgeon General called the nation's number one health problem. And that brings me to the question, so what's the role of religion in all of this? There are some who would say religion is often the cause. I don't think I would go there, but clearly, in all the major religious traditions, there have been and are still teachings that place men with power and control over women. Let's be clear, though. There's nothing in the real teachings of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, or Hinduism that I'm aware of that authorizes or justifies any kind of violence, whether it's emotional, verbal, or physical, towards an intimate partner. There's nothing that allows for demeaning or disrespecting one's partner. But in the practice of religion as it's evolved, it has not always played out that way. Many religions have been interpreted, and sadly some are still being interpreted, to allow men to greatly demean women, even beat them, even kill them, under certain circumstances. These teachings themselves are an abuse of their faith traditions. And also, we have to be very honest when we look at the role of religion and say some religions have just decided to look the other way when there's domestic violence involved. In some faith traditions, teachings about marriage force women to believe they must stay in an abusive relationship. Some even fear harsh judgment by God if they were to leave. I met with an old woman once whose husband had beat her repeatedly over many, many years. And she told me that once she got the courage to do something, she'd gone to her priest. And when she told him that she was thinking about leaving, the priest told her she must stay. Quote, "It was God's will for her, and this was her cross to bear." She said those were the words she was told. Let me just say that no God that I could ever believe in would will that a woman stay in a relationship where she's being abused. Religion has some blame to bear, but at the core of most faith traditions is a very different teaching, a teaching that could never justify physical or emotional abuse of any woman, man, or child. A teaching that has love, compassion, and justice at its center. We as Unitarian Universalists are one articulation of that kind of a faith tradition. From our Judeo-Christian roots, we draw upon the idea that every individual, male or female, is created in the image of God and accordingly deserves such respect. Explicitly, these texts instruct to respect and honor one's spouse. The central teaching of our universalist side of our faith is that God is love, and love is what we are called to bring to the world. And in the words of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, that love is patient, it is slow to anger, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it keeps no record of wrongs, it does not delight in evil. The roots for a much healthier religion, one which takes a strong stand against domestic violence, are clearly spelled out in these early religious texts. And in our current Unitarian Universalist tradition, we have articulated these same teachings in a set of principles, the first of which affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person. So many abused people don't believe they have inherent worth and dignity. They don't believe they are worthy. And it's our second principle. In that one, we are called to make the truth of the first real in our human relationship to each other by affirming compassion, equity, and justice in all human relations. It is clear for us in our history and in our present-day teachings that we are called to speak and act, to be there with great compassion and help for those who are victims, and to work with them to reestablish lives that do affirm their inherent dignity and worth. This church has been particularly active to that end. We're involved in supporting the work of two domestic violence shelters, as you've heard from Diane, and being involved with the distribution of resources and connections for those in need. It's important work, and we all can do more, both as individuals and as a church. But let's not forget that those words of our second principle reminding us we're called to see that there is justice in human relationships are also there. And that means bringing the perpetrator to justice. First, for the protection of the victim, but hopefully also for the rehabilitation of the offender. You know, domestic violence is not genetic. It is learned behavior. Often the abusers have been the abused or have been the witnesses of abuse, particularly if they were children. Our engagement with the perpetrators in a productive way can help to break the generation-to-generation cycle of domestic violence. In our faith tradition, we do not believe, even though people do horrible things, that they are inherently evil. We are a people of hope, not despair, who believe that with the right help, people can change and reclaim their inherent worth and goodness in their lives. So to the darkness of abuse, we say, let the light shine. Let there be light. The more light that shines upon this issue, the greater will be the understanding of the complex multi-generational cycles of abusive behavior. In a faith tradition whose first principle is, as I said, the equal worth and dignity of every person, we have to be out front on this issue, proclaiming that it is never right, for any individual to be demeaned, abused, humiliated, degraded, especially by one with whom they make their home, their safe place, or whom they love. In a faith tradition, with that second principle, which affirms equity, justice, and compassion in human relationships, we have to be out front, supporting the process of justice, which holds perpetrators accountable and helps them to change. We have to be there with compassion for those who have suffered abuse. We have to hold high the banner that says there indeed must be equity in human relationships. I know this is a hard topic to discuss and to hear about. I know some of you have been abused. I know some of you know people who've been abused. I know some of you have been abusers. And I know you know people who have been. If you're in an abusive situation, know there is help here in this church and here in this community. If you are an abuser, Know there is help for you too. Know that here we will do our best also to make sure that our children have the knowledge, values, and self-respect so necessary to help keep them safe and prevent abuse in the next generation. None of us are perfect in our relationship to others, especially to those we love. There are many stressors and strains on our relationship. We are sometimes easy to blame, easy to anger. You know, abuse is not a black or white thing, but it is one of degree. So may we all hold ourselves to a higher standard of love in all our relationships. Each week we light that chalice flame, and it means many things. But among them is our desire to bring our light, the light of the teachings of this faith tradition, to the world, especially to those places of darkness and despair. There is a message in this faith tradition that can help to address this problem. We have to let that light shine everywhere, even and especially in the dark, hidden places of abuse. May we have the courage and the strength and the commitment to do so. Our words of benediction today are from Fred Gillis. May the love which overcomes all difference, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us, now and always. Amen.